Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 228, Buddhism's Fifth Peak.
Okay, well, the time before, we went over Buddhism, and in the sense of we tried to open our minds about it so as not to merely think of it as a religion among religions, like some sort of a system or a structure, and we tried to sort of focus on it as a living thing. And therefore, we looked at it, and since so many of you weren't here, I'm just going to say, we looked at it as a therapy, as a social revolution, as an educational movement, as a deviant, countercultural belief system and affiliation, and a way of art and so on, and life, as a way of life, as a religious system, as a world religion invented by in the modern period, as a contemplative discipline, and finally, I tried to present my view of it, what I would like, the way I would like it to be understood as what I call an evolutionary sport. And I think we made some progress in explaining that, but now most of you are new here, so we'll have to come back to it a little bit. What I mean by an evolutionary sport, that is where I am. The context of today's lecture, having sort of opened up the definition of Buddhism, hopefully, and seen it as integrated with life in a way, not just as something compartmentalized over on one side as quote-unquote a religion, but integrated as somehow something that influences the life of someone who comes to adopt that particular sort of structure of their life and lives. And then today, I conceived of this lecture as a commentary on a lecture I heard about 20 years ago by a great Japanese scholar, the former president, professor of Buddhist studies at Kyoto University for many years, named Gaijin Nagao, which he gave at the Mount Baldy Zen Center one summer years and years ago, about what he called the five peaks, the five high points of Buddhist history, and which I will review with you today. And this is a gentleman who spoke English very haltingly. He's now in his 90s. At that time, he was in his 70s. And very, very slowly speaks English. And he got to the fifth point, and many of the people, because especially a lot of them were Zen students, therefore they were showing their appreciation by nodding off of the that's a Zen tradition. If you nod off, then the speaker is non-dualistic, and that's good. Yeah. It is, and actually, I still have not mastered what my son made to me at the time as the ultimate challenge of a speaker, which is to nod off while speaking. That would really be a sign of achievement, but I cannot master that, unfortunately. I haven't yet. I know a couple of Zen masters who do nod off while speaking, but then they cease to speak. Anyway, it's the fifth peak, the fifth high point in the history of Buddhism, this professor did, and people were kind of like, you know. And after going through the first four, and then the fifth one, he said, well, there, first he said, and then people kind of slightly woke up. Then he said, if there is a fifth peak, it will be here in America, he then said. I mean, I'm speaking slightly more animatedly than he did, but people just jumped up then, and it was a concept that has stayed with me over the years, and so I conceived of this as a commentary on that. But this is really a historical survey today, but in the process of that historical survey, I also will go back to elucidating a little bit, I think, at the beginning, particularly since many of you weren't here before, this concept of Buddhism as an evolutionary sport, which, in a way, I can only say talk about without contrasting it to all the conventional definitions of Buddhism, unfortunately, which I did before. You can listen to the previous lecture on a tape or something if you're interested. So what do I mean by an evolutionary sport? I mean that people respond to the Buddha's discovery, which we call his enlightenment, or the Buddhists call his bodhi, his sambuddhatvam, his expanding, his blossoming, his unfolding of his knowledge, gave him a view of the world and of life, that the purpose of life is to, especially if human life, well, purpose of all life is to find happiness and not to suffer. And particularly the human life form is a life form relative to other life forms, not only in what we would call in our modern sense the animal kingdom, but also other realms, the realms of the hells, of what are called the preta realms, the realms of the various types of beings that are of much more extreme suffering than either human or animals. And then also the godly realms and some sort of titan realms, that, you know, a much sort of broader universe and definition of life than we have. But the Buddha saw this as sort of a great chain of life. And the purpose of all of that life was to attain happiness, and then to reach the human form within that life is a great achievement. The Buddha saw that. He felt that the human being had evolved from billions of beginningless lifetimes in lower states, which were much less pleasurable states, much less powerful, and especially much less intelligent particularly, and without the capability that the human being has to, over here, you have a seat over here, that the human being has to change their programming consciously and with the gift of language and the gift of intelligence and the ability to sort of deprogram and reprogram, which other life forms don't have, as the Buddha saw it. But then the human life form is not an end in itself, because the reason the human life form is great, as he saw it, is that the human being can become a Buddha being, which is not a god, and it's not just a human either. And the human form is the form, sort of the best stepping off place to becoming a Buddha being. And Buddha being is the being that is really the happiest one. And that's why we want to be it. We don't want to be a Buddha being because that would be a religious thing, or because Buddhas are better looking, or because Buddhas get free food, or because they, you know, whatever, they have disciples. We want to be a Buddha being because only when we are Buddha beings will we really be happy. Not just temporarily happy, not just happy until the next pain, until the next ache, until the next death, but really deathlessly happy and infinitely happy. And also not just happy in a way where you're happy and everybody else can lump it type of thing, but where your happiness is such that it enfolds other beings to an inconceivable degree. Look at the Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, on this planet. He was a prince who would have perhaps been able to do well in his small country in that time in India, but actually he still reaches into our lives today. He can, like, he had a good effect on this benighted New Yorker in the 1960s and 70s and 80s and still. And that was quite an achievement to reach from that long distance, you know, at least from my perspective. And so in other words, he had this ability to cheer people up in a very magnified manner. And that's what that's the kind of happiness that you want. You don't want one that excludes other people, preferably. So because that then, that's a, therefore a kind of evolutionary perspective. So that would be Buddha's goal, would be that other beings would find that kind of enlightenment. And other beings, and if you look from such a perspective, which is a beginningless and an endless perspective also, Buddhism rejects the idea that there's a first beginning to the world. Some particular planets and worlds and solar systems and universes may have a beginning, but they themselves are created out of the ending of previous ones. And then simultaneously, there are others that are in other phases of that type of cycle in all different dimensions everywhere. And there are millions of universes inside each atom of this universe, for that matter. You can go infinitely into the microverse without ever reaching zero. You can go infinitely into the macroverse. This entire universe is like a tiny atom in the teacup of one of the Buddhas in another universe who is having some sort of non-caffeine tea. So it's this endless thing in dimensions, an endless thing in time and space, the Buddhist vision of life. And within that, when one achieves Buddhahood itself, which we all can do, then we will really be happy. And that's the point of it. It's not just to sit and worship somebody who is a Buddha, not to just adopt some sort of a belief, but actually to take a hand in our own evolution and to steer that evolution to where we will become permanently and effectively and universally happy. Okay, so that's what I meant by this kind of evolutionary sport. And the way, of course, of getting into that evolutionary sport involves a person expanding their horizon so that, for example, Buddhism traditionally defines the beginning of Buddhist practice as not living for the purpose of this life. That's where it starts. The normal, unreflecting, mundane person who is living the human life as if they were a basically sort of programmed animal, without reflecting on how they're programmed, although, of course, being human, culture, there is, in addition to biological instinctual programming, there's also cultural programming. But without reflecting, you know, living in their myth and, like, you know, keeping the niche that their parents had and, like, following their identities, various layers of identities, and going from birth to death, just sort of fitting into whatever it is, that's sort of a human being who therefore lives for the purpose of this life. They just live for the immediate avoidance of pain and the seeking of some sort of satisfaction. Is really wasting the human life in a way, and it's very tragic from the Buddha's point of view to do that. So the first waking up of something is to, what they say, not live merely for the purpose of this life. It's like as if someone didn't have any forethought and they only live for today and they never thought about tomorrow. And we know that if people did that, even though, you know, some people tell them they should be more here now, but nevertheless, if they only really were for here now, then they would accumulate immense amounts of parking tickets and terrible disasters, messed up houses, families, relationships. Everything would be really in a bad state if people did not at least think about tomorrow, you see. So from the Buddha's point of view, if we didn't think about the following lives and did not make our ethical actions and cultural actions and self-cultivational actions in cognizance of the fact that they're going to have impact beyond this life, what we do, then we're going to make a mess of our sequence of lives. And even though we may be a success in terms defined by the cultures that are focused on the purpose of this life, as he would call it, you know, wealth and fame and some sort of respect, status, and all the different things that people seek, and then dying, leaving all of that, losing all of that, because when you die, you lose all of those things. You lose your bank account, you lose your relationships, you lose your name, you lose everything. But you don't lose your soul. And if you haven't, and Buddha had a soul, don't worry. Well, I'll explain that. There's no lack of soul in Buddhism. It's just there's no fixed soul. There's no soul that is not unchanging. That's all he meant by anatma. No rigid soul, but there's a constantly changing one. And therefore, if you live your life without investing in your soul, then when you die, the soul is like some sort of shriveled little weenie thing that goes off and gets lost somewhere in a bad, and attracted to a bad life form. It doesn't want something like an energetic and lively and beautiful, because it's like it's all shriveled up. Nobody ever gave it anything, you know. You were always busily like slobbering and feeding the body, you know, and feeding the status and the name and all of the attributes of this life, you see. So a person who begins to live for the future life, at least for their own better vantage of evolutionary progress in the future life, is then beginning on the path, although that's what's called the lowest form of traveling on the path. Because they're still self-centered and they're still seeking a kind of relative happiness that even in the future life cannot be permanently lasting. It will not be reliable. So then the second level is where a person has enough foresight to realize that even in a future life, even if they become a god in a Brahma heaven, even they become a Brahma in a different universe, anyone from the Buddhist point of view can become Brahma, a creator, and can make more universes and can like be the big universal ruler, lie around the big giant golden energy body like bigger than the sun and just kind of like spin things out. Anyone can do that. But that itself is a little bit boring, actually, after the first thrill of it, you know. It's quite boring because then you're creating this space and you have all these beings and then they're all basically suffering and you yourself become bored with it, they say. I mean, you know. And you can see how even any kind of state, look at anybody. They get billionaires, they become presidents, they become like rulers, whatever. Then they always do get bored, don't they? And they go off and create scandals and mess around, get drunk because they find it kind of tiresome, you know, the responsibility of it, you know. While one can do that, that in itself will be suffering. So then that person gets enough foresight to see that all states that are based on an individual self-identity that is conceived of as separated from the rest of the beings and from the rest of the universe, so that the basic situation is self versus the universe, is going to be ultimately a miserable state. There will be continuous death, there will be continuous loss. As big and as great as you are, there will be other things that are bigger and greater, and you will lose to them. Right? I mean, it's logical, right? You versus the universe, who will win? Right? Even you get to be supreme, whatever it is, you're still, there's an infinite universe of other supremes who are more supreme than you, and you'll lose. Because even you're supreme, you will die, and so on. So then the middle type of being, they say, gets that and becomes focused in that evolutionary sport on freeing themselves from that basic situation of being self versus the universe. And it can't be done simply by adopting a belief that, well, oh, I'm not the self, I'm the same, it's all one, and so forth. That doesn't work. Consciously, that's good to adopt such an idea. It makes one a little less paranoid, perhaps. But on the other hand, it won't uproot the deeper in sense of being separate, because these things are deeply habituated over billions of lifetimes, that we are sort of this, have this rigid self, and you can't just dislodge that by just having a belief about it. It was at least Buddha's experience. So, and then the other fault with that stage of simply seeking liberation is that you are only seeking liberation for yourself. You're trying to make yourself happy. And the problem with that is that if you have no fixed self unrelated to the rest of the world, if there is no you that is something completely distinct and different, which is the way we feel, right? Each of us feels that there's sort of some irreducible thing in there that absolutely isn't you, right? It absolutely isn't the floor. It absolutely isn't another thing. And we sort of feel that that's the one indubitable thing, right? Remember Descartes? My old buddy Descartes, you know? Who couldn't doubt that he was doubting because he didn't get to a Zen center, poor fellow. So he thought that was an absolute certainty, but that he was simply reflecting our own feeling, which we think it's absolutely certain that we're here type of thing, right? And that sense of that separation, it's down that level that we have that kind of an identity. But if we should discover, as the Buddha said we would, if we really investigate deeply, and not only philosophically but also contemplatively, and not only contemplatively but philosophically also, but a critical intelligence is required, not just a focused mind. And if we come to that realization that there is no such fixed self apart from the world, which is not a realization that we don't exist, actually. That's wrong. Although that's how most Buddhists, in fact, do think of it, unfortunately. Most elite Buddhists who embark on this, and particularly most of us American Buddhists, that's what we think. I still think so, probably, somewhere. But I definitely, totally thought so without even doubting myself for the first 20 years of my Buddhism. And therefore, I was running around as a Buddhist waiting to disappear, you know. I was. I'm sure none of that happened to any of you, you know. When you go to that retreat or you do that big emptiness meditation, I'm sure you're not waiting for yourself to disappear as the sign of your enlightenment, and therefore are highly disappointed when you discover at the end of the weekend that you're still there. But actually, that is not the point. There is no such thing as discovering that you don't exist. Who would it be who would discover it? Right? And really, do we think that all the people of Asia who followed Buddhism were so stupid as to admire a man who just went around saying, I'm not here? And neither are you, and that would be that's the end of our problems. He would be foolish, wouldn't he? And the people to follow such a person would be foolish. They would say, if you're not there, then be quiet. I'm gonna go have lunch. And they'd be quite correct. You see. So in fact, what it is, however, a discovery of the lack of a self that is fixed, rigid, and separated from everything, which means a discovery of the true relativity of the self. The fact that the self is totally interconnected with everybody else. I mean, logically, that follows, doesn't it? It should be very simple. It shouldn't be mysterious, actually. You shouldn't have to be thinking that, gee, I can't really understand what he's saying because I didn't meditate for 30 years. You should easily be able to understand it. It means that the self is all totally interrelated. But then this third type of person, remember, we have the first one who doesn't just live for the purpose of this life. The second one who takes account of the future lives. The second one who lives for liberation and doesn't have a fantasy that some future life, even as a god, will be satisfactory. And then the third one is the one who says, well, although I don't realize it now, because I still feel isolated and alienated, like I have this rigid individuality, nevertheless, I can logically understand that I must only be interconnected with other beings, and therefore I really cannot have a satisfactory happiness without them having happiness, because we're all connected together. And therefore, then from that comes what is known as the bodhisattva vow or will, which means it's a sport of evolving to a perfect happiness for the entirety of the infinity of beings. It sort of puts us on that train, you know, which is quite a shocking thing if you think about it, actually. Imagine seeing all other beings who you know as totally interconnected with you, and not just now because we're all stuck here in this room, but forever. And not just in this life when we happen to have these bodies, but in all future lives. And so that things that we do with each other will reverberate between us infinitely. You know, the one you brush off today will be back next life. And of course, the final way of brushing someone off, naturally, is to kill them, isn't it? That's the human way. If they really bug you, then you blow them away, as they say in the movies. But imagine if everybody you blew away just came back the next life. Sort of a little bit the matter for having been blown away. Unconsciously. You know? And so the Bodhisattva therefore makes this vow that he or she is going to bring all beings into the perfect happiness of Buddhahood. It's going to transform the egocentric universe of alienated, separated individuals into a Buddhaverse, what I call a Buddhaverse or a Buddhaland, a universe that turns into enlightenment. And they do it not because they're so great and so pious and so religious, but because they realize that they're stuck with everybody else. Once you're stuck with everybody else, you might as well optimize the sticking, right? You don't, you know, it's, and the analogy I like to use is the New York subway, which I guess is not so powerful for you Californians since you're always in your isolated little cars zipping down the thruway. But the New York subway is a very special place. You get on that subway, you've got to have a piece of reading material with you if you're alone. And then you look right into it. You never look at anybody else in it, except to see if they might be armed. And then if you looked at them, they would think you were after them or something, and they'd get all paranoid. They might shoot you. So you go in there wanting to have minimal involvement with everybody else there and hoping they won't follow you off when you get off at your stop. Now, the Bodhisattva discovery comes from this opening up to the evolutionary and the boundlessness of life horizon, that is the basic horizon of Buddhism. And that is analogous to you get on that subway, you go down, and it stops in between 96th Street and 91st Street. And suddenly it goes onto a siding, and like panels zap down like in a James Bond movie. And a video monitor comes out, and the mad professor, Bodhisattva professor, is there saying, "You will never leave this car. Your food will be handed in 3 times a day. You will be tranquilized if you try to commit suicide. We will break up any fights. There's a bathroom down there. You will never leave this car." Suddenly you'll start looking at the other people in the subway. Well, first you'll pound the walls and freak out, what is this? There'll be a lot of that. But if it starts to sink in, you will take stock of the people you're with. You're going to be with these people forever. According to your materialist sense that this life is forever, you know, I mean, that's all the forever that you have. Suddenly people would, you know, you'd start a society, wouldn't you? You would have to look at them, talk to them. If there's anybody is armed, all of you would have to disarm them. If there was anybody really lonely, and everyone would have to kind of calm them down. If somebody started having a spaz in the corner, everyone would be concerned. You would have a completely different way of relating to those people, just practically, not because anybody would suddenly have a revelation or become holy in that subway car, but because you're now stuck with all the people in the car. Because you have to be a New Yorker to realize the full impact of it. I guess. That's why I'll never leave New York, because it's the hardest case, you know. So, forever, you know. So, but anyway, that's the Bodhisattva view, you see. You never leave all the other beings. And you never can divorce another being. No, forget it. No way. You cannot disinherit. You cannot disown. If they croak, it doesn't relieve you of worrying about them because they'll be back. And if it's a particularly worrisome type of character, it's even worse because you won't even know which one they are. So therefore, you get the Bodhisattva will, which is every single being, may I make them happy and free of suffering. May I recognize in them my mother. May I recognize in them my father, my lover, my child, my only child. May I see to it that they are happy, not because I'm so great and so holy and so loving, but because if they're not happy, I won't be. So that's then the Bodhisattva. So then this becomes like an evolutionary sport. Now, there's sort of an infinite horizon of that. In the ordinary Mahayana or universal vehicle teaching, the person who has that horizon sees themselves and other beings as having an infinite future. And that infinite future doesn't give them comfort. It doesn't make them think that death is unimportant or death is easy, or it's not some sort of childish notion of being unable to accept their annihilation as the modern materialist or secularist or humanist would try to say, that these are old-fashioned primitive ideas. But rather, this fact of an infinite future gives Buddhists great concern, because an infinite future, it's just like we have great concern about our old age if we're smart. We want to have a pension. We want to know where our medical benefits are coming. We want to have someone to take care of us. We want to have aspirin. We don't want to face that without preparation. And imagine if you look forward to infinite lives, you want to have preparation, because you don't want to suffer infinitely if you're intelligent, or even just normal, you don't want to suffer. So therefore, the Bodhisattva gets into this idea of developing and optimizing, and then they have a vision within that infinite frame of reference of Buddha verses, and the Buddhist literature is filled with amazing visions of heavens and Buddha verses, of the Buddha boundless light, and of the Buddha unbudgeable, and the Buddha delicious incense, and the Buddha this and that, and millions of them. Millions of such Buddhas. And in fact, as Buddhism spread all over Asia, one of the great things that people loved about it was its art form, because they would go in these caves in Central Asia or in India on the caravan routes, and they would polish up a wall, and then they would paint Manet's water lilies on it, and then have a little Buddha in each lily, you know. No, they did. Basically, those Pure Land paintings, just like Manet's water lilies. And imagine you're some camel driver, you've been staggering around the desert, and you walk into some cave, and there you see Manet's water lilies with little Buddhas and Bodhisattvas sitting on the water lilies. And went into China first, the Confucian scholars were very, very down on it, because they said, when those people go in those caves and see the paintings of the Pure Land, Your Majesty, then they will despise the land of Your Majesty, and they won't pay taxes, and they'll run off to become Buddhists. And this would be very bad for the kingdom. It had such a powerful impact on people's imagination, in other words.
Aloha, greetings, and salutations, podcast wallahs. This is podcast producer Justin Stone Diaz, and I'd like to welcome you to this week's episode of the Bob Thurman Podcast. This two-part episode was originally recorded during a series of talks at the California Institute for Integral Studies. To listen to the full archive version of this episode, look in the podcast description or visit the CIIS website at ciis.org. This talk was the fourth in a four-part series, and to listen to each of the previous talks, look in the podcast description. We'll link to the excerpted versions of those episodes, including Buddhism as Evolutionary Sport. The Bob Thurman Podcast is brought to you in part through the generous support of the Tibet House US membership community and listeners like you. To learn more about the benefits of Tibet House membership, including special VIP invites to special events like the annual benefit concert at Carnegie Hall and discounts to programs in New York City and at Menla Retreat and Dewa Spa, please visit tibethouse.org. Your online participation and monthly donations help support the mission of Tibet House US to present and preserve Tibetan culture in the West. Every membership, like, comment, share, or subscription helps do the same, and we deeply appreciate all your support. To learn more about the ongoing work of Tibet House US, and to enjoy free archive recordings of past programs, please visit the Tibet House US YouTube channel. Interstitial music for the Bob Thurman podcast is generously supplied by our dear friend Tenzing Chogyal. Used with the artist's permission, all rights reserved. To learn more about Tenzing Chogyal and to listen to more music by him, visit his website at tenzingchogyal.org. Poetry for the Bob Thurman podcast is generously read by Gary Gock. To learn more about the work and poetry of Gary Gock, visit the podcast description and visit his website at garygock.org. And now, back to the second half of this week's episode, which concludes the reading of poetry by our dear friend Gary Gock. Tashi Dilek, and thanks for tuning in.
I have to admit that Buddha was a little bit hesitant to open up this possibility to women, but not because, he said, then they said, well, why? But can't they attain enlightenment? Of course they can. Actually, they can do it easier than men, he said. Because they are more, they know better what trouble life is if you have this wrong definition of the self, you know, this wrong sub-perception of the self. But he said, if we open up this escape hatch for women in this society, so many will come that the elders and the patriarchs and the priests and the soldiers will come and take us away, because they want those women back in the kitchen and in the bed and in the various places where they use them. But nevertheless, they prevailed upon him, and he did, and there was a huge burst of women leaving these drudgery life patterns and entering into this free space, which was known as the Sangha, the monastic community. And we call it monastic, and we have an image of monastic in America that it's something very filled with deprivation, where when you go, you sort of can't have any fun anymore, and you have to look gloomy, and wear a hair shirt, and flagellate yourself, and so forth. But, and there are kinds of monasticism like that, but Buddhist monasticism is not like that. The word to be ordained, which you translate to be ordained in English about a Buddhist monk, ordained means come under orders. Primary motivation or primary virtue in a Western Christian monk is obedience. Not for a Buddhist monk. That same word means to be fulfilled, to escape, actually. You know, I'm going to go over to the monastery and get escaped, is what the actual literal word means. I'm going to be a person who gets out of the prison. Because suddenly, first you were working and slaving, you were a soldier, you were a priest, you had to work all life long. If you're a woman, you had to bear 10 children. You had to, like, slave from dawn till dusk. You were totally aged by the age of 22. And so the language of it is the language, and then suddenly people feed you, and you're free, and you have a very, relatively speaking, easier time. You're respected. And of course, mentally, you confront your own death, you go through these things, but that's a pleasure, actually, because that's just a reality, and you deal with it, and once you have dealt with it, you're actually a lot more alive. It's not some grisly business, you know. Like the Buddhist monks and nuns used to sit, one of the things, well, those of them particularly who were very attached, you know, who were like really into the mirror and the whole thing, you know, they would just, the first week, they would sit there and meditate on a visualization of themselves as a rotted, bloating corpse, sitting in front of themselves, self-dibbling out, and very soon they were cooled out about the lack of lipstick and things. They felt quite good, and actually, usually they became more beautiful by becoming less self-conscious and worried about it, by getting rid of that layer of vanity, you know. So anyway, I call these kind of people are people who sort of live in one foot in history and in human society and in sort of their own state of development and one foot off planet, kind of. You sort of don't really live in the same way on the planet. You live in a kind of detached way where you sort of half there and half not there. And once you live like that, then you change your society. And what can the society do with you? The Buddha had been trained to be a general. He had been trained to be el presidente. So he knew what to do with large groups of people. And he also had been trained to raise funds, and he knew that they were almost impossible to get. And so he had everybody on a total low budget. You know, no salaries, only lunch, which was free, No big fancy clothes, just an orange toga, shaved hair, so no lice problem, you know. Presidente didn't fool around, you know, just, someone said they wanted to escape, they would meet him, and they would listen to the four truths about the truth of freedom, the truth of suffering, the truth of seeing through the misperception of the self, and getting rid of the emotional addictions and the emotional pains and afflictions that they had, and they would say, I want to enter the order, I want to enter the community under the guidance of the realized one. And he would say, come here, mendicant. He would just say like that. And then the hair would fly off and their clothes would change. He had like this instant service. Really. The just hair would just go zip right off like that. It's written in the books. I mean, it may be hagiography. I don't know, you know. We can, Westerners can feel safe if we call it hagiography, you know. So, and then once you had that happening, and this starts to snowball in a society, obviously what happens in that society? A lot of people start going out for that free lunch. People start dropping out, don't want to serve in the army. People, ladies don't want to serve in the family. Young men don't want to be trained for the priesthood. Warriors don't want to stop the martial arts and go and do this, you see, because this is this kind of a tremendous explosion of sense of freedom, you see. Every time you think about selflessness, every time you question the unquestionable, rigid self that is there, that's the absolute center of everything, you know, there is the most unbelievable relief that you get. If you can hang in there, and if you can just turn on it. And actually, that is what is called in Buddhism taking refuge in the Dharma, taking refuge in reality, taking refuge in voidness, in selflessness, in freedom. That is when you sort of begin the process of getting free. So anyway, this happened in India, and it changed everything in India. And it was parallel with the Upanishadic movement there, which was like the conservative wing of that movement. It was trying to do that and yet remain within the caste system and remain within the society, so they weren't quite willing to go off planet, in the way I put it. And the Jains did it too, and they were a little even more strict. Okay? So then the first great peak in Buddhist history was that peak in the mid-first millennium of the Common Era, before the Common Era, and it was the time of the famous Axial Age, and it reverberated, if you have that view, it reverberates over the entire planet in all of the different societies. For the first time, people begin to think about freedom. In the less wealthy, less developed societies, such as the Mediterranean society or the Chinese society, you weren't able to do that because the rulers wouldn't let you have that free lunch. There was no free lunches in the West Asia. There was no free lunch in China. So therefore, Confucius didn't get an order like that. He couldn't make a community like that. Socrates couldn't make a community like that, right? Socrates was El Presidente of Athens in that day, and they gave him a hemlock milkshake when he went out and asked for the presidio, you know. They did. They said he'd be corrupting the youth in that, and it said, here, scoff it down. You know? Our great advanced Greeks, you know. They had no time, they had no space, they had no energy, they were too scared of the Spartans. They didn't have mangoes, they had olives and feta cheese. So, but this was that great peak anyway. And the essence of the peak, the way I want to express it, is this idea of people breaking out of all of the routine patterns of culture as well as of personal instinctual drivenness and becoming enlightened and free in their own instinctual structures and then creating this space for enlightenment within the society. I call it the Swiss cheese theory. You have a one big cheese, which was the Brahminical society, where there was no room for anybody to break out. No, actually, need. There wasn't even the idea before, around this time, of liberation from being part of the cheese. And then from this time, these people began to say there's a way of being liberated. You don't just have to follow the role. You don't just rise up or down in the world at the will of the gods. You yourself can attain understanding. You can do good deeds. You can transform your own evolution. And everyone is free to go beyond the gods as well as beyond the human form. So that was the first one. Now, it is said, from the Buddhists, the Mahayana Buddhists particularly, such as myself, believe that the Buddha also simultaneously taught a kind of more what we would call a non-dualistic teaching, which was this bodhisattva vision that you're all interconnected with other beings since you're selfless, since there's no absolute you that is apart from everything else, but you're totally interconnected with everything else. Therefore, you must actually bring others with you into that freedom, and therefore love is as much of a, and compassion are as important to cultivate as wisdom. But the Buddha, you know, we believe that the Buddha taught that himself. We don't believe it was made up later. But we believe that he kept that a little quiet at the time, because he was dealing with a very patriarchal male chauvinist society, militaristic society. And if people had been told that, you know, that they had to be in that subway car forever, you know, right away, they might have freaked. They might have gone berserk. They might have become depressed. So they had to have something that corresponded with their self-centeredness, where they could feel that they at least can get free themselves, that there's some sort of a nirvana that's sort of outside somewhere. So he sort of promoted that one a little bit. But, I mean, it doesn't, of course, make sense. If you have no self, who's going to be sitting out there in nirvana, you know? Where's nirvana? No place. This thing that was thought it was separated and apart and wanted to create a sort of absolute realm of separateness and apartness to go and sit in, this thing itself just flew off. You know, sort of like letting a pigeon just fly out of your hand, this thing like a pigeon just flies out of your chest. And suddenly it isn't there quacking anymore, you know. It's gone. And then those poor monks, like in the Lotus Sutra, Shariputra said, you know, I thought I was going to get to nirvana, and now I was walking around here in the mango grove, and there was a Buddha was over there, and you sort of misled me, Buddha, didn't you? He was kind of mad, actually, because he thought he could just get away from it all, you know, never any more dishes to wash, you know, never any more, nobody to scold him, nobody to correct him. He could just be nirvana permanently, you know, the ultimate male chauvinist fantasy, that is. So, but he held back on this one of the total interconnectedness because of its being too much for people. He taught it subliminally, like he said, well, I got to be Buddha, guys. You guys are just, you know, free, you're saints, but you don't know how to really put it together because you're not Buddhas. Why? Well, look at all what I did. You know, and then he told like 5,000 Jatakas, former lives. And then they looked and they kind of like were happy that they didn't have to be Buddhas because, you know, the Buddha and the Jataka stories, any of you know the former life stories of the Buddha, it's like one experience of another of serving up dinner out of yourself. Like when Buddha is the bunny, you know, he's Bugs Bunny. He doesn't just go around and go, what's up, Doc? He goes, what's up, Doc, is I'm for dinner. When Buddha is Mickey Mouse, he's like feeding the fox. When Buddha's, you know, he's like more than Lassie, in other words. He's like constantly giving himself up. So people would read those Jataka stories and they would see the incredible sort of self-transcendingness that lies in the Buddhist theory of biology, of how one develops by these moments of altruism and generosity and self-giving, and that's how beings become higher, not by hunting and being aggressive and being nasty, but by transcending oneself is how one gains more self, more relative self. And so this is told. So Buddha told all those stories, and all the monks could see, and the nuns could see. That's how you get to be a Buddha, actually. Beyond just a monk, you get to have the ability to not only be free and happy yourself, but really enfold a lot of other people in that happiness. And then they thought, well, I'm glad he did it. And he didn't say to them, sorry, guys, you all have to do that. That's what he said to the Bodhisattvas. He said, you all have to go through millions of lives like this, you see, over millions of aeons, you see. He taught that larger altruistic teaching, but he didn't push it on people too hard. So I think he withheld that until the place had become more pacified. And it became more pacified by the Swiss cheese method, right? More and more little sanghas, more and more little monastic sanghas and nunneries, you know. It was incredibly subversive. Why? Because who enrolled in his class at this place? The son of the untouchable, the son of the Shudra, the son of the merchant, the priest, they're all sitting there rubbing elbows. And that's extremely subversive, right? You're of a higher caste, you never speak to these people of a lower caste, you mustn't, and there's all these ritual taboos, all this stuff. And then suddenly your kids are cheek by jowl in the same academy, and you go over and go to graduation or take them lunch or listen to their lectures or whatever. And they're sitting right there. You're feeding them. You see, you, the Brahman, are feeding the untouchable, you see. Because they're a monk now and they're out of the caste system, you see. So by creating that safety valve, that outside space, you have a very strong impact on the place, you see. And after 400 years, India had calmed down a lot. In the meantime, it had become more or less organized. The merchants saw to it that it became sort of federated, empired, you could say. Although they really didn't make an empire until they were reacting to the invasion of Alexander the Great. Because they were a little lazy for empiring because they had enough mangoes, they didn't want to bother, you know. Around the first century of the Common Era, or zero of the Common Era, the Mahayana emerged in force with its literature, and that's what Professor Nagao calls the second great peak in Buddhist history. And that's when this guy Nagarjuna, the one who achieved his aim with the help of the Nagas, and the Nagas are sort of undersea dragons, and it's a very nice myth. He was giving a lecture one day, and he noticed a couple of dragons in the back row. But they were posing as human, you know, not to frighten the rest of the audience. Same time as Christ in Christianity, and same time as the Mencius movement in China, And actually, everywhere things were loosening up at this point, about 500 years after that. And that's the second great height. It was a movement out of the monastery more aggressively into the society. They weren't any longer taking the stance that we're not interfering with your society. They were telling the presidentes, the kings, change the society, do this and do this and do this. In Nagarjuna's writing in the second century of the Common Era, in his own book, not the sutra that he found, but in his own book, he writes to a king that there should be no capital punishment. Second century of the Common Era, no capital punishment. He says, every single prisoner, even the vilest murderer, you should think of as your own son. He's there to be re-educated by you. Don't ever think to kill that person, to do this and do that. And also send barbers into the prison and doctors and give them good food and teach them. Second century of the Common Era. And it was, and then in the energy of that movement, it spread all through the Kushan Empire into Iran, Afghanistan, through Central Asia, the Silk Route, and began to move into China at that time. Also went to Sri Lanka and began to develop monasticism in Sri Lanka from around that time, a little earlier. So that's what he called the second great peak. So in other words, it's this movement of people doing this off-planet way of living for their evolution in this multiplicity of lives and developing. And it spread without any war, without any jihad. It spread by the energy of people creating in their own hearts this refuge from the reactivity of the normal bound and instinct-driven and compulsive way of living of unreflecting humans. And then everyone found this very useful to them. People had a wish to, because the human being wants to delink itself. You know, the human life form is precisely the life form that is ready to be delinked. That's why it is such a valuable life form. Precisely because of the flexibility is the key thing. So now when Nagao taught at the third great peak was, he says, it was Tang Dynasty China. Tang Dynasty China was where Buddhism had been in China about 400 years. And it had been slowly finding a safe place for people away from the ancestors, and some women had escaped from the extended family, and you know, people were, you know, Bodhidharma had come and glared down the emperor and told him to butt out, you know, and all this. And you know, they were slowly trying to make a crack in this very rigid social structure of the China, the ancient China, which was like no more rigid than Europe, about like the West. And then the Tang Dynasty time was great because that was when the Chinese were able to really create a Chinese kind of Buddhism. And you had the four great schools, the Jingdu Pure Land School, the Chan School, you know, the beginning of Zen, which came from the Siddha traditions of India, the Huayan School from the Avatamsaka Flower Ornament Sutra, and the Tiantai School from the Lotus Sutra. And they sort of organized the schools on some of the famous, based on the famous sutras that had come all from India. So then the fourth great peak came at a time actually when mythically Buddhists basically felt Buddhism was exhausted on the planet. By the 13th, 14th century, there was sort of a general theory around in Buddhism, wherever it still survived, that it was finished, that it was the Mappo, as they said in Japan, that it was the Kali Yuga. So this old Brahminical, slightly depressed, historical degeneration cycle sort of vision that came originally from Brahmanism was adopted by the Buddhists. They said, well, the Buddha's Dharma, we're too far away from the Buddha's time. You know, Buddhism is exhausted. It's the time of the counterfeit Dharma. No one really will get in this off-world thing. Buddhism is left over here and there vestigially as a religion. Somebody believing Buddha was back there way back. Somebody got enlightened back then. But there's no living thing, you see. And the whole Pure Land movement in Japan of Kamakura Buddhism, which Nagao Sensei said was the fourth great peak, came out of adapting to the situation of sort of the dark times, you see. Like the Pure Land school in Japan was that only Buddha can save you because your own will is too corrupt in the dark age. And you have to therefore be saved by Amida Buddha, Namo Amida Butsu, and you give up your own self, you know, this what they call Zettai Tariki, the complete other power of the Buddha. Zen guys were still machoing it out there with their samurai intensity, and they had a great renaissance by doing that. And Nichiren had revived the Lotus Sutra vision in Kamakura. And there's no doubt, as Nagao says, that the 13th, 14th, and 15th centuries in Japan was a tremendous kind of renaissance and a wonderful peak of achievement in Buddhist history. And then again, he didn't acknowledge, like he didn't like the Tantra in India, and he didn't really acknowledge, although he was a Tibetan scholar, that what happened in Tibet at the same time was also very, very crucial for the planet. But Tibet had a huge renaissance at that time, and unlike in Japan, the Tibetans went way further in the monasticization of that country. So now we come to the fifth one. Now the fifth one, Nagao said, should be us, the Americans. It cannot happen in Asia, he said. And that's when people began to wake up. He had them all passing out like all of you are now doing. He said, cannot happen in Asia because in Asia, Buddhism has been reduced and compartmentalized as a sort of a little religion somewhere. So we're ready to be off planet. We have a Star Trek. We have our imagination is all unlimbered. So I think Nagao meant that we have this opportunity now because we realize the futility of accumulation of wealth. And we've realized it for as a thing in itself. We've realized the futility of status and posture and sort of identity and this and that. So we know everything. We have this flood of information. And then there is this methodology. Well, how do you cope with being off planet? That is then the methodology. But I'm saying that how do the existing institutions of Buddhism that have brought to us this type of suggestion, which is something new. We always like to say, oh, we have everything here in the West, but we don't, actually. We didn't have the idea in the West of relativity until recently, and even still, that's not a thorough relativity such as Buddha discovered 2,500 years ago. And we definitely don't have the idea that any one of us, the brains of any one of us, is capable of becoming virtually omniscient, and that the hearts of any one of us is capable of becoming totally loving and compassionate to a degree of completely ability to give everything to everyone, even our lives, if it would be helpful. We do not have a teaching that we are all capable of doing that. But the idea that each one of us can do that, not only that, but each one of us should do that, and that each one of us will do that inevitably before we'll be really happy, is very new to us. We were never given. In fact, you might rightfully want to have me locked up for cultivating megalomania. I admit it. I'm ready to go. But that is what there is in the Buddhist culture. There is this level of esteem for the human embodiment and its capability. And cultures built on Buddhism are focused around the possibility of the individual human beings in them achieving these levels of evolution. So then the next task is to take the existing ways we have received and understood Buddhism as a religion or as a meditation discipline or whatever we do understand it as, and the way we perceive it as it comes from Asia and exists in Asia, and see whether those institutions are up to this job of providing us, if numbers of us get into this off-planet type of perspective and multi-life and infinite horizon type of perspective, an infinite meaningfulness type of perspective. Where are we going to find the help? And what are you going to do when you're suddenly wandering in the universe? You're way past the end of history. And you're into like multi-infinite history. You know, you need a little bit of help with that, probably. So where to find the help? And that's what we will begin to evaluate in the next lecture. Okay? Thank you.
Poet is William Carlos Williams, a Puerto Rican American poet who lived from 1883 to 1963 and is considered one of the ancestors of 20th century modernism in literature, surely, along with Gertrude Stein, James Joyce, Ezra Pound, T.S. Eliot, H.D., and Wallace Stevens, to name but a few. Thursday. I have had my dream, like others, and it has come to nothing, so that I remain now carelessly with feet planted on the ground and look up at the sky, feeling my clothes about me, the weight of my body in my shoes, the rim of my hat, air passing in and out at my nose, and decide to dream no more. 1921. Gary Gock, and this poetry segment is a part of the Bob Thurman podcast and is published by Tibet House US, Menla Retreat, and Dewa Spa under a Creative Commons Attribution, non-commercial, no derivatives license. Please feel free to share, redistribute, and post via your favorite online portal.